Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over a million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, guys, thank you for tuning in. We have got two experts on the JFK assassination with us this evening. We've got Matt Crumpton and Fred Litwin. And loads of questions have come in all day from the viewers as various angles and aspects that you guys want to discuss. It's going to be absolutely fascinating. Trump is about to release these files. So obviously loads of questions have come up about that, what we can expect to be released. And the main themes are conspiracy versus lone gunman. So if you've got questions, put them in the chat. We will save them. We will put them to the guys as we go along. But a huge thank you to Fred and Matt for coming on. And before we get into it then, Fred, first, would you like to just tell the viewers a little bit about your background and what got you into this, please?
Well, I got into this in 1975 when I saw the Zapruder film on the Geraldo Rivera show. And I realized, oh my God, what's going on here? It looks like Kennedy was shot from the front. And how do we explain this? And so I went to the library. This is back in 75. Got interested, started writing doctors and all sorts of people. And it just snowballed from there. And ultimately, I ended up writing 4 books debunking conspiracy theories on the JFK assassination.
Yeah, and both of our panelists' book links are in the description box below this video. So we've got On the Trail of Delusion, Jim Garrison, The Great Accuser is one of them. And then we've got A Heritage of Nonsense, Jim Garrison's Tales of Mystery and Imagination, Oliver Stone's Film Flat, The Demagogue of Dealey Plaza. And I Was a Teenage JFK Conspiracy Freak. I've also got the link to Fred's blog down there. But I'll bring Matt in now so he can give his perspective on what led him to his interest in JFK, please.
I've been interested in the case ever since I was a kid, and I saw the music video for Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire with Ruby standing behind, you know, killing Oswald behind Billy Joel when he's in the kitchen. And, you know, all it took was the Zapruder film plus the knowledge that Ruby was killed, or that Ruby killed Oswald a few days later. And I said, hey, wait a minute, this is a thing. And then, I studied the case my whole life. And then I basically wanted to compare what are the conspiracy arguments or the critical arguments versus the official story / Warren Report defender or whatever arguments. And that's kind of what my podcast does. We go point by point and we kind of just look at the arguments. And so I don't equally, you know, weight both arguments the same. Obviously I have my perspective, but the point of my show is for people to at least know what the arguments are. And, you know, I think a lot of times in the this whole conversation about the JFK assassination, I find to be a microcosm of our discussion about politics. There's another reason I started it. What's happened is we're kind of in our own little groups, conspiracy people with conspiracy people and sort of the official story folks stick together. And then when there is a debate, what happens a lot of time is just like politics, there's a thing called whataboutism, where somebody makes a good point and then the other side, instead of addressing the point, they change the subject to something else, which maybe is a good point, but they never address the first point. So my whole thing is like, okay, let's go issue by issue so that we can't slip out. And I don't know the answers to everything. Some things I go, yeah, I don't know, that's a good point, but there's also this, so it's inconclusive. You know what I mean?
All right. So Matt is the co-op of the JFK assassination chokeholds that proved there was a conspiracy. Matt is an attorney and host of the Solving JFK podcast, which just passed 2 million downloads. Wow. And he's also appeared as a commentator in JFK, What the Doctors Saw on Paramount Plus. All right. So, Fred, how many shooters, in your opinion, were there?
There was just one shooter, and that was Lee Harvey Oswald firing from the Texas School Book Depository.
And did you think his gun had the capability to perform this assassination?
Oh, well, easily. He was a sharpshooter in the Marines. And if you ever go to Daly Plaza, you'll see, oh, my God, these are easy shots. I mean, the first shot was 55 yards. The last shot was 85 yards. Very easy shots. He had around 10 seconds to fire three times. Easy, really easy. So there's nothing to this. And he had the ability to do this.
What was his motivation?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, it's hard because he was killed by Jack Ruby. He never told us. So the best we can do is to sort of look at his life and try and come up with some idea of why he did it. I believe that he did it because of Cuba and that he was very, very angry at what he saw the United States doing to Fidel Castro. And he wanted to strike a blow for the Cuban Revolution. If you go back in September 1963, Oswald was living in New Orleans. And there was an article in the New Orleans Times-Picayune, September 9th, reporting on a speech that Castro gave in Havana, warning American leaders that they would not be safe if the attacks on Cuba continued. I'm sure Oswald saw that article and was incensed at what was happening. And here was a chance to strike a blow for the Cuban Revolution.
So one of our viewers wants to get your thoughts. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's bring you in. Yeah, definitely.
Can I respond? Okay. So the straightforward points Fred makes certainly make a ton of sense if that was all the information. It's just, that's not all the information. So when it comes to Oswald in particular, Fred said that Oswald was a sharpshooter in the Marines. Let's talk about that. We have two shooting tests from the Marines. One in 1956, where indeed Oswald scored 212 out of 250 to get this sharpshooter ranking. The only other one is right as he was leaving the Marines in 1959, he scored the minimum score to pass, which is marksman. You get, you start at 190 on this test. Oswald got a 191. So to say, you can't just say, ooh, he's a sharpshooter without including the fact that, wait a minute, he biffed the only other test he did. That's 50% of the tests he's even on record taking. Second of all, there are numerous Marines who served with Oswald who said that he was an embarrassingly poor shot. Okay, I cover all this in detail in my podcast. the other thing, If Oswald was a shooter, we would expect a shooter to have practice. Because what Fred said, I just want to say this. You go to the museum, Dealey Plaza, and you look at how close it is. It is very close. Absolutely. Anybody off the street, you hand them a gun, even this .30-06, they probably could have hit one of those shots. Okay. But the challenge is this is a bolt action rifle, okay, which has, everything in the case is disputed, by the way, every little thing. But anyway, but the bolt action rifle there's a window of how long it could possibly take. And so you're working with the window of how long we know the fastest person that's ever done the bolt action rifle in those shots versus the time in the Zapruder film. Okay. So anyway, to say all that, Oswald would have needed practice, a lot of practice, but the official story is that the last time he had practice was in a random field near the airport where he took a rifle on a bus, according to Marina, his wife, in April. There is not even an allegation that Oswald had any practice at all, okay? I mean, Fred, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not even aware of an allegation. And the last point is, so Oswald could not have done it. He didn't have practice. He wasn't a good shooter. And then not even the pros could do it. Okay. So what do I mean by that? Well, the FBI tried to recreate for the Warren Commission what they said happened. They set up shooters at stationary targets from only 30 feet up. Well, Oswald was 60 feet up on the sixth floor. Five out of the six world-class riflemen who tried to hit all three shots in the allocated time failed. Later in 1967, CBS News ran a more accurate experiment. They had 11 professional marksmen trying to hit a moving target from 60 feet up. Those 11 pros took 37 attempts to hit two of the three shots. They were successful in three, or 8.1% of the time for world-class marksmen. So that's my rebuttal to Fred's point.
If I can just reply, I mean, I think that, look, Oswald was a marksman at the end of his time in the Marines, but that was also a time when he really gave up and really didn't care much. Now, he was still, you could fail the test. There were three levels. He still got the minimum level, which is a marksman, which is still a pretty good shot. And you could actually go see his Marine scorebook, and it's really good. I mean, he hit the target an awful lot. The problem with the test that you say, I mean, everything you say is correct. The problem here is the test that they did was really trying to do three shots in 5.6 seconds. He had 10 seconds. If you really tested that with a marksman and gave them 10 seconds, they'd have no trouble hitting the target. There was lots of time. This was very, very easy. And we know he did it because it was his rifle.
What about Oswald's history then, psychologically? Because we had Ernst Titovits on, who claimed to be Oswald's best friend in Russia. And he said that Oswald didn't have a violent bone in his body. Did he have a history of, you know, whereby he was capable of performing an assassination on the president? Any kind of red flags? Well,
I think you would say that about anybody who was accused of shooting a president. Oh my God, we never saw that. But Oswald did have a violent past. He pulled a knife at his own mother. He pulled the knife on his stepbrother. So he did have some violence, and of course he beat his wife. But yeah, you know, people change. So the Oswald that Titovits saw in the Soviet Union was slightly different from the Oswald a few years later. And he had changed somewhat.
I mean, I would just add that, it's true that Oswald did beat his wife. And it's also true that he pulled a knife on his mom when he was in New York. But these are the wife beating. I'm not going to defend, obviously, but you know, pulling a knife on his mom, she was not that nice of a person. I'm just kidding. I'm not going to defend that either. But no. But it's an isolated incident, and so, you know, Oswald certainly was not known to drink. He was not known to go around and get in fights with other people. But yes, it's absolutely true that he did beat his wife, and he did pull a knife on his mom when he was like 11 or 12.
Okay, Fred. So what about the possibility of Oswald being used? Let's just assume Oswald did it. Are you saying that he just did it without any outside help? Is there a possibility that he could have had outside help?
I don't think he had outside help. There is one unanswered question, and there is the possibility that maybe somebody in Dallas was egging him on. You know, say, hey, you should do this. I mean, that is certainly a possibility. I don't think it's true because he was such a loner. I mean, here was a man who really had very few friends, hung out with very few people, had very few known associates. So I don't think he was used, and I don't think somebody egged him on, but that is possible.
So yeah, I mean, I would just, if I could just, I mean, obviously I don't think Oswald fired any shots at all. So I think he was a patsy purely like he says he was. But one thing that Fred said, which I think is an important point to address, is that we know it was Oswald. You forget the could he done it or not. We know it was because it was his gun. Okay. And it's true. Again, you look at the surface level. If you just read Gerald Posner, then 1,000%. The lone gunman team wins. Okay. It's just that there's a lot more information. So we look at this, and yeah, it's got C2766. It's got the serial number stamped on the rifle. It's the same one that's linked to Oswald's PO box. Hey, that looks bad for Oswald. Okay. But here, let me just give you a few facts to chew on. Oswald ordered a rifle that was 36 inches long. They sent him a rifle that was 40 inches long. Okay. I mean, maybe they ran out of 36 inch rifles, but that is definitely an anomaly. Oswald mailed the money order, supposedly, and the rifle order form on March 12th from Dallas. But the money order was deposited the next day in Chicago. So we're mailing. You put it in the mail on March 12th, and then it gets to Chicago. How long does it take to get to Chicago? I mean, it wasn't overnight, first class. There wasn't a jet. But let's assume it gets there in one day, which I don't think at all is the case. You still have to receive it at the place, at Klein's. They have to process it, then they have to send someone to go deposit it. So that is definitely an anomaly that is deposited the next day. No one ever saw Oswald pick up the rifle or the pistol from the post office. We have no witnesses that saw that. He never signed for it. Oh, and by the way, the Dallas postal inspector was reading Oswald's mail as of April 1963. And we're supposed to believe that the postal inspector would not have been aware of guns that were shipped to a PO box of someone whose mail he was reading. And then finally, the name on the P.O. box was Lee Oswald, but the rifle was ordered in the name of A.J. Hiddell. So I don't dispute that the rifle was physically present on the sixth floor. I do dispute that there is any, you know, I think there are real problems with the evidence to you know, hang your hat on the fact that the gun is there is the proof.
So Bailey's asking you, is the actual story covered up to protect someone else?
Depends who you ask. I mean, what Fred would say no. I would say yes. So yeah.
Well, I actually will say I do actually believe there were cover-ups, and I think this is what really makes the case so interesting. I think there were a lot of cover-ups. The CIA was covering up their involvement in trying to assassinate Castro. The FBI was trying to cover up the letter that Oswald sent about his threats to the FBI building or office. Secret Service was covering up their stuff. You had all these cover-ups going on, and so these cover-ups made it appear that there's a big conspiracy, that they're covering up a conspiracy, but no, they were covering their ass. That's the cover-ups that happened.
So, Matt, Casper is asking, what was Ruth Payne's involvement other than the landlady?
Ruth Payne, that's a fun one. Here's the deal with Ruth Payne. I mean, there's her involvement was basically she met Marina Oswald at a party. It was actually George de Morenschild's going away party. And she then pursues a relationship with Marina Oswald and tries to get Marina and Marina's two-year-old June to move in to her house. So it's, you know, the arguments are, was Ruth Payne just a nice lady who's trying to help these people? And by the way, she was interested in Russian and she spoke Russian. And so the argument is, well, she wanted someone to converse with in Russian who was recently from the Soviet Union. But the issue with Ruth Payne is there's all these shady, first of all, there's all these pieces of evidence that come from Ruth Payne. So that in and of itself doesn't prove anything about Ruth Payne, because if the evidence really was there, if it really was bad evidence for Oswald and Ruth Payne happened to find it, then we would expect her to have the evidence. But it's just like there's the hits keep coming. There's just, you know, item after item of all the things that that she found. And then she has all these wild connections. And that's kind of what gets people's attention, is the connections that Ruth Payne has. So her dad worked for, hey, this is in the news right now, USAID, which was admittedly, indisputably a CIA cutout at the time. Some people would say it still is today. And her sister was a W-2 salaried employee of the CIA. Her brother-in-law also worked for USAID. Her dad was friends with, not friends, her dad knew George de Morenschild from their business dealings in Haiti. That's crazy. I mean, maybe coincidences do exist. Okay. The big question is, what's your coincidence threshold? Okay. That's the question. They definitely exist. But okay. So it keeps going. Ruth's husband, Michael, his stepdad was the creator of the inventor of Bell Helicopter and Arthur Young. And so her husband had a high level military security clearance. And her husband's mother was best friends. And again, we're now we're going husband's mother's best friend. I get it. That's not a direct tie, but just listen to what I'm gonna say. Michael Payne's mom's best friend was Alan Dulles's mistress. Okay. And you go, okay, it was his mistress during World War II. Who cares? Okay. But they remained close friends. They remained close. The mistress actually became closer with Alan Dulles's wife than with Dulles in later years. So that's weird. And so I can look at all that, even the Dulles part, and I can go, coincidences. That's weird. But what gets me, it's funny, different facts get different people, right? What gets me is there's a witness whose name I forget off the top of my head. Maybe I can find it for you here. But basically, his name is Frederick Osborne Jr. He's a character witness for the Paynes, and he's brought in to say, look, these are upstanding people. They're great. And Frederick Osborne Jr.'s dad was Alan Dulles' best friend in college. Now, when I say best friend, you can attack best friend, but there's dozens of letters back and forth. They indisputably worked closely together. Okay. So again, but what have I said? Just ties. All I've said is ties that she has. Okay. So the thing, once we get, and you can, there's a lot more with Ruth Payne, by the way, and people who want me to go deep in on Ruth Payne are going to be disappointed that I didn't go through the whole thing. There's more. There's much more. There's about 12 different things. But the bottom line is, there is not one individual, and my perspective is that Ruth Payne was involved, okay? That is what I think after looking at the evidence. But that is only because of the cumulative evidence altogether. There is not a single smoking gun that definitively proves that Ruth Payne was involved. And she's still alive, by the way. I can't say she did it, right? Because that's defamation, and I don't have proof of that. I can say when we look at these 11 facts, you go, huh, that's my coincidence threshold has been surpassed. I just can't believe that. So that's my position on Ruth Payne.
I saw Fred shaking his head a few times there.
Well, you know, I mean, here it is. I mean, I actually spent 3 or 4 days with Ruth Payne at the 60th anniversary in Dallas. So I hung out with her for three or four. She's a wonderful woman who has spent her whole life trying to help people. She is really, really a beautiful person. Again, there's no evidence of that she did anything untoward. I mean, she just tried to help. She tried to be a nice person. She took in Marina Oswald as a boarder. She felt, wouldn't it be nice? You have kids. I have kids. We could both help babysit. You can teach me Russian. It's a good deal. I'm separated from my husband. It's good for you. It's good for me. She helped Oswald get a job, and all of a sudden, because of, you know, oh, a brother-in-law, this relative or that relative, she's accused of being involved in the assassination with no evidence at all. I mean, a nice lady. I mean, she could have sued all sorts of people for slander over the years, but she just sort of laughs it off as meaningless. You know, her sister worked for her sister did translation work. I mean, so what? So Michael, her husband worked for Bell Helicopter. Who cares? What does this have to do with anything? It's nothing to do with the assassination. There's no evidence about Ruth Payne being anything but a good Samaritan who helped Marina Oswald and helped Lee Harvey Oswald.
Sean, if I could, I got it's 60 seconds is all it'll take. I'll lay out the case. Okay. Here you go. Number one, Ruth aggressively pursued a relationship with Marina. Okay. And she's the one courting friendship with Marina. It's not the other way around. Number two, Marina living with Ruth meant that any extra belongings the Oswalds had would be stored in Ruth's garage. That meant as soon as Oswald put his bag there, anything could be put in it. And oh my gosh, look what we found in Oswald's bag. And in this case, this goes back to the evidence I was talking about. The blanket that the police said had an imprint of a rifle on it was found. Backyard photograph of Oswald with the rifle and the pistol. Photographs of General Walker's house. The Imperial reflex camera allegedly used to take the backyard photos. And these things just leak out. They don't all come at one time. Ruth's typewriter is used to write this incendiary letter that Oswald supposedly wrote to the Soviet embassy that supposedly confirms his Mexico City trip. The FBI was not able to find any other documents that were created using that typewriter. Ruth is the one that gets Oswald the job at the school book depository. You can say she's a nice guy, but come on, she gets him the job. And then she passes on the opportunity. Or she does not tell him about an opportunity for a higher paying job as an airline baggage handler a few days later. The Paynes I talked about all their connections. The Paynes were Quakers, a religion that regularly worked with intelligence agencies after World War I. In fact, they did that so commonly that the KGB put any Quaker or Unitarian welfare agencies under suspicion. There's an FBI report about a potentially incriminating phone call between Bell Helicopter and the Payne residence on the day of the assassination, where they both say, quote, or no, where one voice says, a male voice says, quote, we know who was responsible. And that, you know, they said Oswald did it, but we really know who was responsible. So whatever that means. And then on the day of the assassination, Ruth tells the cops, we've been expecting you. So, okay, maybe there's a reason to say that. Maybe, you know, they expected Oswald to have called Marina by that point and he didn't call or whatever. I mean, maybe there's an argument for that. But then Michael Payne shows up at the house and he's separated and his job's 40 minutes away and he shows up at the house right when the cops do. So it's almost impossible that he would have been there in time if he didn't already know. Okay, and how would they know? Just because Oswald works there? Next, Payne is the Michael Payne is the first person in the whole world who says the possibility publicly that Oswald is connected to the General Walker shooting. And he does it on the day after the assassination. Jim Garrison says that he subpoenaed the federal tax returns of the Paynes, but he was told that he could not access them due to national security. During that same trial, Marina Oswald was told by Secret Service agents not to hang out with Ruth Payne because she was affiliated with the CIA. And finally, Sheriff Buddy Walther says that he found filing cabinets containing records that appeared to be names and activities of Cuban sympathizers. And we also know that Michael Payne is going around meeting with random people going, hey, Cuba's pretty cool, huh? You like Cuba, right? What's your name? So, you know, now the counter argument, everything I said, there's a counter argument to every single thing is a counter. There's a counter argument. I just don't think on the whole that the counter arguments are all persuasive.
All right, let's bring
a counter argument to all of that. I mean, all of that is just a bunch of nothing. Those filing cabinets did not contain names of Cubans. There's
what do you think? What do you think Buddy Walters wrote that in his report?
Oh, I think he made a mistake. You know, I mean, there's lots of things. Lots of things like that. I mean, Ruth Payne got Oswald the job. Well, yeah, she heard about an opening at the Texas School Book Depository from Buell Wesley Fraser's sister, and she told Oswald. So what? I mean, what are you implying there? There's nothing there. All this stuff adds
up. I'm implying that she put him in position to be in the school book depository.
She didn't know it. Nobody knew that was going to be where the motorcade was going to go in October.
Unless they had deep foreknowledge, which is what the accusation.
Deep foreknowledge? Are you saying she had deep foreknowledge?
I'm saying that somehow Ruth Payne, in my opinion, looking at the evidence, I'm not making a statement of fact.
There's no evidence. You're just giving me sort of.
I just laid out the evidence.
There's no evidence.
If the viewers think that there's no evidence, that they can think that. You're just making a statement. I just laid it out. So whatever you want to do.
I know, but you're just laying out these random occurrences that have no evidence that she was involved in anything.
Well, that's why I go back to my point. It is a circumstantial case on Ruth Payne. There's not one single smoking gun. Okay. There's not. It's everything all together is the case.
All right, let's keep going, guys. We've got almost 1,000 people watching live right now. And with Fred Litwin and Matt Crumpton, we've got so many questions coming in. This could go all night, but we've only got another hour before the next show. So thank you for the super chat, Rivs. Ask Fred to explain that FBI Field Office Dallas 89431A122, which is an envelope regarding a 7.65 bullet found 10 days later after the assassination in Dealey Plaza.
Just real quick, the reason that matters is because the bullet, the CE-399 from the Mannlicher Carcano, was a 6.5 millimeter. If it's 7.5 millimeter, then that would not match that. And also 7.5 millimeter is consistent with what the two people, O.P. Wright and Tom Linson, who found CE-399 later, said that matched the bullet they actually found.
No, so that's not true. That's not true. If you look at the interview that Tomlinson gave to Ray Marcus in 1966, he definitively identified CE-399 as the bullet he found. I posted that interview on my website. He definitively said that's the bullet. Nobody quotes that interview, but he did say that.
Well, that's fact is under dispute.
It's not under dispute. I've posted that interview on my website. You could see it yourself. That's Ray Marcus, who was a critic, and that's what Tomlinson told him.
Well, while we're talking about the CE-399, let's talk about Barbara.
I don't know much about the 7.65 bullet. Who found it? Where it was? I don't know anything about the provenance of that at all.
While we're talking about bullets, Fred, are you getting asked whether you believe the magic bullet theory?
No, I don't believe the magic bullet theory. I believe the single bullet theory. The single bullet theory holds that one bullet went through Kennedy's neck, went through Connolly's chest, and then went through his wrist and lodged in his thigh. I believe that. It's been proved, I think, beyond a reasonable doubt. They were lined up completely. The bullet showed exactly the wear and tear it would by going through those, causing those seven wounds. It completely holds up in every way, shape, form, and manner. So yes, I believe the single bullet theory. And I think that in fact, Discovery did a very good test of the single bullet theory, and their bullet came out almost exactly like CE-399.
What do you think about the magic bullets or flash single bullet theory?
Yeah. So, all right, there's a few points here. All right, so the first thing we're talking about to start this whole thing off is, where did the bullet enter President Kennedy's body? That's the first question. Because
we have pictures of that.
We do indeed. We know
exactly where that bullet entered.
Right. And it's far lower and far further to the right than the magic bullet theory.
Not at all.
Would say.
Completely wrong. We have pictures that show exactly where that bullet entered.
I agree. There's a picture of JFK laying on his side with his head pulled back like this so that it looks like his neck.
The picture of him lying on his stomach, you can see his back. You can see exactly where that bullet hole is.
Yeah, we'll have to look at the exact picture. People can go find it online for themselves. But in addition to the photo, which clearly demonstrates that it's where I'm saying it is, we have the death certificate itself, which says it's at T3, not T1, so down materially lower. And it also, there's the FBI Cybert O'Neill report, which is huge. The FBI Cybert O'Neill report is one of the central documents here. J. Edgar Hoover. So, you know, the good news is we've got these turf battles amongst these different agencies. Hoover wanted to have his own guys there, his own eyes in the autopsy. So he sent two agents, Seibert and O'Neill, and they documented what they saw. They just wrote everything down. And in their report, it says that they probed the wound in Kennedy's back and they could just get their pinky finger in just a little bit. It did not go all the way through. They were not able to get it.
That absolutely means nothing.
They were not able to get probes through.
That's why you would dissect the wound, because the muscles move, the body, you know, that happens all the time.
They didn't dissect the wound.
They should have, right. But they didn't.
Exactly.
But the fact that they couldn't put their finger in, that means nothing.
Hi there. My name is Annie Elise, a.k.a. your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialistly. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialistly with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, the what it does mean is that the only test that was done to determine whether or not it was a through and through wound, which was not a thorough test, I agree with you, concluded that it was not a through and through wound. So game over already.
That's not true. There was a bruise on the lung. There was all sorts of evidence of a through and through wound. Even Cyril Wecht. Wrote in his analysis of the medical evidence that it was a through and through wound.
Did you read the
1972 report?
Yeah, I did. I would encourage everyone to.
What did Cyril Weck say about the bullet wound in the neck? It was a through and through wound.
Yeah, I mean, look, Cyril Weck's not.
No, he's
right
a,
about
he's
every
a good forensic pathologist. Do you think he's wrong?
Maybe. I'm not committing to everything
I'm just saying.
Hang on, there's more.
The best forensic pathologist on the conspiracy side is Cyril Wecht. He said it's a through-and-through wound.
Good. Great. Cyril Wecht's dead.
Every single forensic pathologist who has examined the autopsy x-rays and photos say it's a through-and-through wound.
It's true that the HSCA medical panel did conclude that
the medical panel
theory was correct.
Rockefeller medical panel? Every
disagree with their findings. Let me just add, there's a hole in JFK's shirt and suit coat, and that hole is exactly where the wound is.
No, it's not.
The counter argument Fred's about to make is that JFK was hunched over like this.
No, that's not the argument at all. The argument is that you could see in many, many pictures, his suit jacket was punched.
Yeah, but not nearly as much as it would have to be for your theory to make sense. So again, people can look at this for themselves. I would encourage you, look at the Cyber O'Neill report. Look at the photo. Tell me, is the photo at the base of the neck where Gerald Ford said it was? Or is it really down into the right?
Forget Gerald Ford. Doesn't matter.
We have a picture, and you and I are talking about the same picture, but we're describing it in different ways. And the reason that you would think that it's closer to the top is because his head is back like this in the photo.
That's not true.
But let me just say this too. All right, so there's that. Let's talk about CE-399, the magic bullet itself. Okay, people say it's pristine, it's perfect. It's not perfect. It's got a ding on the bottom. Now when I looked at it,
the whole bullet is flattened.
On the where?
If you look at the side view, you can see how flattened it is. That's because it hit on the side of the rib, and you know you can see that the bullet is not
the bottom of the bullet.
Nobody claimed it's pristine.
The bottom of the bullet is certainly affected. If that's what you're referencing, I wouldn't call it flat.
If you look at a side view of CE-399, you will see that it's quite flattened.
Okay. So there's actually, if you look at this bullet, there's a little dent in the nose. And I was always like, ah, that's where the damage is. But that wasn't even from, that was them cutting out the metal so they could do the test of it, hilariously. Now, people say that, look, the bullet that was fired from the sixth floor, the Carcano ammo, matches the bullet, the fragments that were found in the car. But they use something called neuron activation analysis for neutron activation analysis, NAA, which has since been discredited and isn't used anymore by the FBI starting in, I believe, 2005. Okay. So, all right. Now, the other thing is CE-399. Supposedly, it went through Kennedy's soft tissue, hit Connolly's rib, wrist, and thigh, and it's still in this condition it's in. But the HSCA looked at bullets that were fired at human wrist cadavers, at a goat, and they're just totally mangled and destroyed. I mean, it speaks for itself. Now, the counter argument is
there's a reason for that. The reason is the bullets were mangled because they were fired directly into a wrist bone, not going through soft tissue and slowing down.
Okay, but
there's a reason for that.
I understand that. However, we're not talking about going through a sponge. We're talking about going. So the theory then is the bullet comes in, it goes through Kennedy's body, which slows it down. Okay. But still has enough velocity to continue to go through Connolly's body and hit a wrist, slows it down, but then still has enough velocity to go into Connolly's wrist, smash his wrist, and then come out his wrist, slows it down, but still has enough velocity to go in his leg.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay,
that's
not credible.
Have you not seen the discovery?
Discovery did
a really good test of the single bullet theory. They recreated every part of this, and the bullet has amazing penetrating power. That's been shown many times by the Hogs. You could see the PBS special. There's nothing special about this.
The bullet fragments that were recovered from Governor Connolly. If you look at those bullet fragments, which, hey, magic single bullet theory, it's one bullet, right? Those fragments, by definition of the single bullet theory, must have come from that bullet. So I would challenge everyone to look up, and I'll tweet it here. I'm solving JFK on Twitter here. Look at the CE-399. Look at the image of the fragments that were recovered from Connolly's body. Tell me how the puzzle fits.
Lead was extruded from the center of that bullet, and that's where those fragments come, and they're all lead fragments.
Lead was extruded from the center of the bullet. Why does it still look so perfect? Why does it look so perfect in the center if lead came out of it? Where
did it come from? The bullet got flattened, and therefore it pushed out lead from the bottom of the bullet, and those are the fragments.
But that's not what the fragments are. Random jagged pieces. They don't.
Oh, no, of course they break off. I mean, they're all from the lead. They're all lead. They're not copper fragments.
I'm not trying to convince you of anything, Fred. You believe what you believe, but the audience can listen to this and go, "What's reasonable? Is that reasonable?"
Absolutely. And I think if you look at a good GIF picture of Kennedy and Connolly, you'll see that they react at exactly the same time. You see Connolly's shirt. Basically the lapel of his jacket goes out exactly when Kennedy is shot. They react at the exact same time. And they're aligned, completely aligned.
Back to CE-399. Dr. Shaw, the surgeon who worked on Governor Connolly at Parkland, said that the bullet was still in Connolly's thigh when he gave a press conference. And that press conference was after the time that the bullet was discovered.
There's a lot of statements where people are wrong.
Speaking of the Parkland doctors, let's talk. So, and Sean, I just want to throw this out there. Here's the big question with this whole case. It really just comes down to this. Here's the big Rorschach test question.
Here we go. The big question.
It does. And I'll say that before I dove super deep, I was a little bit more open on this question. Okay. But I'm not now. and here's the question. What's more reasonable? Okay. For the first 43 people who look at President Kennedy and witness his body, his head after the assassination, 43 people in their initial statements said there was a large hole in the right rear of his head. Now, some of those, about a dozen or so, later did change their testimony. That is true. But their initial statements, we're talking about doctors, nurses, folks at Bethesda. It wasn't just at Parkland. So the question is, did they all just have a mass hallucination? Are all of those people wrong? Or your other option, which is not a good option. Like, I'll agree that this other option is not a good option. It sounds crazy on its face, okay? The other option is the autopsy, which shows that the rear of his head is fully intact. There's no hole at all. So the autopsy has to be fraudulent and forged, which is a massive claim. And it's like, oh my gosh, would our government forge the autopsy of the president? Oh, holy, what are the implications of that? So if you only knew that information, that's a tough conundrum. It really is. Wow, really? Do 43 people have a mass hallucination or what? But once you understand that, wait a minute, there is evidence of medical fraud. There is evidence of forgery in the form of John Stringer, who is supposed to be the photographer.
I want to talk about Stringer.
He says that those weren't the same photos he took. That's he used true. A different type of film. He says that the photos were taken from the base of the brain, and he didn't take photos like that. He says that the brain he saw was all mashed up, and the cerebellum was messed up, which, by the way, is the same thing that the Parkland doctor said, which is not consistent with the Warren report. So you have a photographer that's supporting the idea that, hey, this doesn't make sense. Then you have Sandra Spencer, who's the lady who processed the prints, and she knew it was a big event. She took an example of the paper that she processed the prints with home with her that day. And then when the Assassination Records Review Board called her years later to come talk to them, she brought it in. She goes, look, this is the paper we used. And then they showed her the actual documents. And she goes, she turns over, looks at the back. She goes, this is not the same thing. Okay, so you got her. Then you've got David Mantic, who, you know, folks on the other side will make fun of this guy. But let me just tell you this. That I haven't heard a refutation of David Mantic. And so for example, so let me say what David Mantic says. Mantic is a PhD radiologist oncologist. So his job is to study x-rays. This is what he does for a living. He went to the National Archives. He got access to the original autopsy photos, and he used a device called an optical densitometer to look at the x-rays. And the rear of Kennedy's head, where it's bright white, so it shows that it's intact. The whiteness is so bright white that the bone is hundreds of times more dense than the surrounding bone, which means that it cannot be possible. It's a forgery. Okay. So I'm an attorney. David Mantic would qualify under the Daubert standard to be an expert in court on this matter. I'm not aware of any other experts refuting what Mantic said. Go ahead, Fred. Is there a refutation of that?
Okay, how much time do I have to respond to all of that?
Fred, you've gotten as much time as you like. We've still got 45 minutes or so left.
Because each of those requires, let's start with the Parkland doctors. Kennedy was brought to Parkland Hospital. The doctors who were working on, they were frantically trying to save this man's life. There were a lot of people in the room, a lot of doctors, nurses, all sorts of people trying to work on Kennedy. They were not examining the wounds. They were trying to save this man's life. They were in there for around 15, maybe 18 minutes at most, a very small amount of time. If you check the ARB testimony of Dr. Peters, Dr. Peters told the ARB, look, the back of his head, and don't forget, Kennedy was on a stretcher on his back and it was on an angle. So they couldn't see, but he said it was a mess of hair and bone and blood. You could barely make out what it was. He said it's very hard. You should read his testimony. It's very hard to know exactly what happened. And no, all of those Parkland doctors have slightly different testimonies about what they saw. Let me go on to John Stringer. John Stringer is one of my favorite ones. I like to talk about John Stringer. He was the autopsy photographer. And if you actually read his ARRB testimony, the first thing you'll note, and it's 200 pages long, but the first thing you'll note is that all the autopsy photographs, he says, yes, I took those pictures. The one thing that I noted was his memory was very poor. All throughout his testimony to the ARB was, I can't remember, I don't know, I'm not sure, I really can't say. Over and over and over again, he's clearly had some major memory problems. He never said he didn't take the photograph of the brain. And in fact, guess who wrote a book about his life after the ARB? John Stringer. Have you read his book?
No, I've not read John Stringer's book, no.
I have his book. I have John Stringer's book. He wrote a book. His whole last chapter was on the autopsy and Kennedy, and he definitively states that he took the picture of the brain. And that is the picture that he saw is the brain that was removed the night of the autopsy. It's there in black and white in his book. He says that.
And that, so that's news to me. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, well, it's on my
blog. What about Sandra Spencer? Did Sandra Spencer write a book?
Hey, Sandra Spencer. Let's go to Sandra Spencer. If you look at Sandra Spencer's testimony and you look at what she described the body that looked like it was in the mortuary. She said everything was neat. There was no blood. There was a picture, a vat of the brain on the side. She described something that maybe she saw pictures that were taken surreptitiously at the morgue, but she was not describing pictures that were taken at the autopsy for sure. You go look at her testimony. It cannot be a Kennedy's body at the autopsy.
What about the paper? The whole, her whole point of her testimony is the paper was different.
Well, yes, so because she might have definitely seen pictures that were taken after the autopsy at the morgue. That's quite possible. But the pictures that she describes, look at those descriptions. They cannot be of Kennedy's body at the autopsy. There was blood everywhere. It's just impossible. David Mantic is not a forensic pathologist. As I said, every forensic pathologist who has examined the autopsy x-rays and photos has come back with the same conclusion, that Kennedy was hit from behind, one shot in the head, one shot in the neck. They all agree. You got the Rockefeller panel, you got the Clark panel, you have the HSCA panel, you also have the forensic pathologists that were talked to by the ARB. In fact, if you look at, there was a forensic radiologist who testified before the ARB, and Douglas Horn, who was very much trying to prove a conspiracy, asked him, what do you think about what the Parkland doctors said? And he replied, I don't care. I don't care at all. They are completely irrelevant to analyzing this case because we do not rely upon hospital doctors. That's why we have autopsies. There's been many studies that show that doctors make mistakes in their analysis of wounds compared to the autopsy. That's why we do an autopsy, because we have specialists who come in and tell us exactly what happened. This happened in the assassination, the killing of John Lennon. The attending physician at John Lennon looked at the wounds. He thought it happened one way. The autopsy said, no, you're wrong. It happened another way. And that happens all the time.
Fred, you've got a question from Lunchbox, and it is, why are David Morales and Jack Valenti on the side of the Secret Service car in McIntyre photo number 2?
Well, they aren't.
Well, Jack Valenti was, because he was in LBJ's detail, was he not?
Maybe Jack, but not David Morales. But
David Morales, if somebody says they see David Morales there, that's a disputed issue. I think it could be David Morales, but that's certainly not proven by any means.
Okay. You've got another question here, Fred, and it was, do you think that Oswald shot Tibbet?
Yes, definitely. This one's a slam dunk. I mean, yes, Oswald shot Tibbet. There were lots of witnesses one witness who saw him shoot Tibbet and many witnesses who saw him either running away or getting rid of the shells from his gun. He was caught with the gun that killed Tibbet. The shells from that gun were identified to that gun. This is a slam dunk. He killed Tibbet.
If we're talking about photos, talk about the McIntyre 2 photo.
Can I respond to Tibbet real quick?
Go ahead.
Yep.
Sean. All right. So yeah, Tibbet's an interesting one because there's a timeline that's laid out by the Warren Commission. Okay. And so if you look at literally using the Warren Commission's own times, Oswald would have been leaving his rooming house around 103, 104, or something like that. I mean, this is literally front. Fred, what would you say it is if it's not that?
Well, if you go to Earlene Roberts, said that he came in just for a few seconds, few minutes. All he did was he came in, he got his gun, and left. That doesn't take 3, 4, 5 minutes. I think that he arrived around 12:57, right before a 1 o'clock show came on, and he was out the door, just after 1 o'clock.
That's what, okay, I said 103 or 104. You said just after 1 o'clock. So, okay.
Yeah, well, three minutes makes a difference.
So anyway, the time that Tibbet is shot ranges between 105 to 115. Okay. There's a wide range, but there's a guy who's got a watch on and he comes by and it's 110 and Tippett's already on the ground. That's Bally, TF Bally, or not Bally. That's I forgot the guy's name, but there's a billion names in this thing. So not great going off the dome. We just did this thing. We threw this thing together today. But anyway, so the counterpoint is everyone's watches must have been wrong. Okay. That's right. Well, but if time matters at all, there's no possible way Oswald could have shot Tippett. Second of all, the witnesses weren't sure. Okay. It's not like it was overwhelming that they saw Oswald in the lineup. They were like, oh, that kind of looks like him. And many of them, I think seven alive. And so this is, if you're on the conspiracy side, Tippett is, that's a tough one. Okay. But the answer is, the night of the lineup, they said where he worked, and he's wearing a t-shirt and he's got a black eye and Oswald's protesting in front of all the people. So it's as an attorney, that would have been thrown out immediately. It was absolutely an unfair lineup. But the other thing is Oswald's wearing a brown shirt, a white t-shirt and a brown shirt. Okay. He's arrested with his brown shirt on. Zero witnesses said that he had a brown shirt under his jacket. Yes. He's wearing a jacket. Yes. But what did he have it zipped up all the way? No one saw that. Zero witnesses. Also, and this is really extremely telling, the prime witness for Tippett, Helen Markham, what she says, okay, is that Tippett was driving behind Oswald, okay, and she didn't know his name was Oswald, but the cop was driving behind the man. The police car stopped, and then the man stopped. And then the man walked back to the cop car, put his arms in the window of the car and starts talking to the cop. Is that what you do when you kill the president? You walk towards the cop car and approach it? That makes no sense. They were speaking to each other like they knew each other. And then the man walked around and killed Tippett. And then also you got problems with timing at the Texas Theater because Butch Burroughs says that Oswald arrived at 107. So what I think happened is that there was someone who looked like Oswald, which sounds crazy. I agree. But we have 27 documented instances of it with FBI reports. 27. Not all of those are legit, but not all of those are made up. Okay. You can go one by one on the podcast.
I can, yeah.
But we have those instances. So, yeah, I absolutely believe that there was an Oswald imposter who had been used to set up Oswald throughout the case, who was there, who was the one everybody saw, who was not wearing a brown shirt. And then he led them into the Texas Theater. By the way, he threw his coat in a random parking lot, his jacket, and Captain Westbrook shows up and he finds the coat. It's amazing. Captain Westbrook, who's in charge, he's like the head HR officer. He finds it. Isn't that great? And then Captain Westbrook goes to work for the CIA in Vietnam the next month. But that's a coincidence. Coincidence. It might be. But really, how many do we believe?
Look, let me just talk about Tippett for a minute. I mean, a few years ago when I was in Dallas, I'm 68 years old now. So this is when I was around 64 years old. We decided to time it. How long would it take to go from Oswald's rooming house to where Tippett was killed? I was with a couple of friends. I'm in my 60s. Now, Oswald was an in shape 24-year-old. I'm a out of shape 65 or 64-year-old. It took me a little over 12 minutes to get from Oswald's rooming house to the Tippett murder. He left there around 1 o'clock, 101, 102. Tippett was shot at 1:15. He had plenty of time to do that. There's no problem with the timing at all. And by the way, back then Oswald could have gone there by going through gardens and back roads because there weren't the fences that there are today. So he could have been running as opposed to walking. So he had lots of time to get there. So there's no timing problem with Tippett at all.
Yeah, let me just tell everybody one more thing about this case and the Texas Theater that is I'd be really curious to hear your answer to this one, Fred. Carl Mather. So that's where I'm going. All right, so Oswald is seen by two people say they see Oswald arrested out the back of the Texas Theater. Okay, Butch Burroughs, who's a concessionaire there, and Bernard Hare, who owned Bernie's hobby house next door. He says he sees Oswald be taken out the back of the theater. Well, of course, Oswald wasn't taken out the back. He was taken out the front. We know that. There's documented photos of it. Stuart Reed took one of them. He's a whole different conversation. But anyway, the question is, are Bernie Hare and Butch Burrows just totally making this up? Interesting in light of the fact there's 27 other sightings, and interesting in light of this fact right here. A few minutes after that, so Oswald's arrested. So this guy who's a mechanic at Mac Pate's garage, he sees this guy who looks suspicious, who's sitting in a car across the street. And he walks over to look at the man, and the man makes eye contact with him and creeps him out. He knows the president had been killed. He knows a cop had been shot. He doesn't know anything else about it. Oswald's photo wasn't on TV yet, so he didn't know at this point. But the man, as the car drove away, he writes down the license plate number. Okay. Well, a few weeks later, there's a news broadcaster there, and the owner of the mechanic shop comes and talks to the news broadcaster who's at this restaurant and says, "Hey, you know, one of my guys saw this. Can you run this license plate?" So Wes Wise, who's the newscaster who would go on to be mayor of Dallas, Wes Wise has some connections in law enforcement, and they run this license plate number. The license plate number comes back to a 1957 Plymouth, which is a different vehicle than the vehicle that T.F. White saw this guy in. Okay, so it is a different vehicle. But it comes back to a 1957 Plymouth that's owned by Carl Mather. Well, who's Carl Mather? Carl Mather was a high-security communications contractor for Collins Radio. He personally installed the special electronics equipment on Vice President Johnson's plane, and he refused to speak to the FBI. Mather was very close to Tippit, too. Him and their families were close. In fact, they found out that Tippit was killed because Marie Tippit called them. Why is it his license plate? Explain that to me. And then he goes to testify to the HSCA, he won't speak to them. He won't consent to an interview with them in 1978 unless he's granted immunity, so he doesn't end up talking to them. What is that? I can't explain that story. Can you help me make that one make sense, Fred?
Well, let me start off with the Burroughs and the Hare one. That's a real easy one to explain. First off, Mr. Hare never came up with that story until the 1980s. I mean, that story first surfaced in Jim Marr's book. That's not a story that was told right after the fact. It was told many, many years later. And it was clear that he saw Oswald in the front of the theater being escorted away. He said that. And then he claims later, you know, well, it was also I saw somebody else being taken out the back. Burroughs, go check his testimony at the time, as opposed to what he said in the 80s. Completely different testimony in 1963. That whole Burroughs hair thing is a complete nothing burger.
What about Mather's?
I don't see what there is in that one either. I don't know that one in detail, to be honest.
But well, a license plate from a car that looked like Oswald in it immediately after Oswald was arrested nearby at the Texas Theater, two blocks away. He comes back to Tippett's best friend, who's a military contractor. You don't see what's going on. You don't see something there?
The Roger Craig sighting of Oswald, you know, getting into a Rambler.
Roger Craig and four other people. It's not just Roger Craig.
That's not true.
There are five people who saw the man get into a Rambler. Three of them identified
himself. Perhaps the man got into a Rambler. It wasn't Oswald.
Okay, but five people saw a guy run out of the back of the school book depository, come down the hill, get into a green Nash Rambler.
Some people saw somebody get into a Rambler, not necessarily from the Texas school book depository, and certainly it wasn't Oswald because we know where Oswald was.
Okay, I mean, I agree that it can't be, that Oswald can't be in two places at one time, but it is definitely true that three of these people, Roger Craig and two other ones.
Roger Craig has no credibility at all. I mean,
I know because they all want to be famous. Is that why, Fred? So the counterpoint to any evidence that someone who believes that the official story, any bad evidence like I just brought up is they were in it.
Roger Craig, you can't believe severe mental bad in this case, committed suicide, and he has no credibility at all. He was the one, by the way, he was the one who identified Edgar Eugene Bradley outside the Texas School Book Depository that led to Jim Garrison charging Edgar Eugene Bradley with conspiring to kill Kennedy. That didn't happen. That wasn't right. Garrison had to apologize to Edgar Eugene Bradley, and he relied upon Roger Craig for that identification.
Ribs,
is that not true, Matt? Is that not true, Edgar Eugene Bradley?
Eugene Bradley.
Edgar Eugene Bradley was not the promoter of Radio that Garrison charged with conspiring to kill Kennedy. And there was absolutely nothing to it. And Garrison eventually had to drop the charges and apologize. And so it was based on Roger Craig's identification. Yeah.
Roger Craig was the sheriff of the year in what, 1961?
Yep.
Something like that. So he went from being the sheriff of the year to a psychopath who makes stuff up. Is that the deal?
Do you think that Edgar Eugene Bradley would conspire to kill Kennedy?
I don't. Are you talking about Eugene Braden?
Nope.
Is that the same guy?
Edgar Eugene Bradley. Garrison charged him with conspiring to kill Kennedy.
Well, there's a lot of problems with the Garrison case. That's why the first time you relied upon
Roger Craig. Roger Craig was his witness in that.
If you guys go to Solving JFK and watch my channel, the first time Fred and I had a talk, it was a lot more cordial because we agreed about a lot more. We pretty much disagree about everything here. But I will say this. I want to give Fred his flowers, as they say these days. What Fred is good, what I appreciate about Fred is that he does have thorough research, and he's good at sort of knocking down the certainty around some of the excesses, some of the crazy stuff, I think, in my view. But it just comes to a question again of like, okay, here's the information, and thus, what is your interpretation of it? And that's why, you know.
I have to say, Matt, I would love to have a beer with you one day. I'd love to sit down at a bar and have a night drinking.
Cheers,
let's
man.
Move on. Okay. Let's move on to Ribs. Ribs is saying, if you're talking about photos, talk about the McIntyre number 2 photo and the Willis 10. Extra gunmen and rifles are spotted. Debate over. What do you say to that, Fred?
Well, I guess the debate's over. I guess we should end the program. There's nothing more to be said. Look, if there really were gunmen and rifles in those pictures, the HSCA would have noticed them. They didn't. The Warren Commission didn't. Nobody. I mean, there are no photos of other gunmen, guns anywhere. It's just not true.
But wasn't the Warren Commission rigged?
What's that?
No, it was not rigged.
Do you think the Warren Commission was rigged, Matt?
Yes, definitely. I mean, just look, listen. Was it rigged? What's the definition of the word? What does the word rigged mean? Let's define the word rigged. I mean, here, just for
question.
Fun.
That's a good question.
So rigged. I'm looking it up. Dictionary. It means
the fix is in.
Hi there. My name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to. Diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't know. These are a lot of weird. This is not the same.
I think the attorneys and the Warren Commission would have loved to have proven conspiracy. It would have made their careers if they would have been the ones who would have proved that there was a conspiracy. No. They didn't want it. They did their best to find out what happened, and all the evidence led to Oswald.
Yeah.
Was part of the rigging putting Dulles on the investigation?
No, Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy wanted Dulles on the Warren Commission. That was Johnson did that at the request of Robert Kennedy.
I don't know. It's possible that RFK made some statement at some point that
he did. There's a memo. It's in writing.
LBJ is the one who wanted Dulles.
Wanted Dulles on the commission.
To answer your question about was it rigged, you've got the guy that JFK fired for messing up the Bay of Pigs, really for lying to him about what he had told others.
They were friends
regarding the Bay of Pigs.
They were good friends.
And you're saying Dulles was friends with JFK?
Oh, absolutely. Dulles and JFK were very good friends. They were family friends. They spent a lot of time. They were very good friends. This is people have this all wrong.
Okay, what evidence do you have to support that claim?
Oh, the families knew each other for a long time. There were a lot of socializing between the Kennedys and the Dulles family.
You're saying,
and you can even listen to the tape when there was racial strife in Mississippi. Lyndon Johnson called in Robert Kennedy to talk about what should he do. And Robert Kennedy says, let's get Alan Dulles to do this. And you could see the warmth when they get Dulles on the phone.
After he's fired or before?
after this is after the assassination. Right. This is in the summer of 1964. When Johnson you could hear the tape. Johnson gets Cadullis on the phone, mm-hmm. and Bobby and Alan Dulles, they're on first name basis. They're very friendly.
Well, here's the deal. If you want it, so I mean, again, people can look and see if they believe that. I mean, that's I don't think I buy that, but the big picture is what's going on here. How did Johnson get these folks to be on the committee? And the answer is, and this is not really disputable because we have that on tape. Okay. Johnson called, listen to the Richard Russell tape. Johnson calls Senator Richard Russell and says, hey, Hoover told me that Oswald was meeting with the Soviets in Mexico City. So it's possible that the Soviets were involved. If we pursue this, what we may find is that the Soviets were involved. Okay. And so if people find that out, they're going to want us to have a first strike nuclear war, and then it's going to kill 40 million Americans right away. So he's saying, I need to count on you to maybe not tell that. He doesn't say, I want you to lie, but he says, you put on your uniform and you do what's right for your country, because 40 million Americans are going to die. Going to die if what? If you follow the logical conclusion of the case that shows that he was working with the Soviets, which, by the way, was a total lie. And how do we know that's a total lie? Because what LBJ is telling Richard Russell is, hey, let me tell you about a little incident in Mexico City that J. Edgar Hoover told me about, where Oswald met with the Soviets. It's true that Hoover did tell him that. But you know what else Hoover told him? That it wasn't really Oswald. It was an imposter. And LBJ did not relay that information to everybody else. He just said, it's the Soviets. So everybody in the Warren Commission, everybody in the FBI, easy for them to lie. Because what are they doing? They're saving the world. They're preventing nuclear war by lying. Of course.
This is just, you know, this is just not true. Look, the Warren Commission knew that the Soviets were not involved because of the NSA intercepts. The NSA intercepts were quite clear that the Soviets were not involved. They knew that. Are you claiming the Soviets were involved?
No, they definitely weren't involved. That was a lie.
So the people in the Warren Commission knew that. Everybody knew that. Of course, look, Warren.
We have a tape, Fred.
What? I'm sorry?
What do you think about the Richard Russell tape?
Well, you know, look, at the beginning, I mean, there was a lot of uncertainty about a lot of things. Johnson worried, of course, that there might be a nuclear war if the Soviets really were involved. He wanted to find out the truth. He needed to know the truth. The truth is they weren't. And we know that. We know that today for sure because of the NSA intercepts, I should say. The Soviets, Matt, you know it. The Soviets were not involved.
Matt, you're being asked if you think any foreign country could have been involved.
For me? No, I mean, well, so I don't want to give away my whole season three here, but let me just say, zooming out, I can speak with some authority on things I've studied, and I'm taking the case, like dissecting it point by point. So there are some entire bodies of facts that I haven't even looked at. Okay. So, but season three, I'm looking at, well, who could it be if not Oswald, right? We're going to look at Cuba. We're going to look at the Soviet Union. We're going to look at Israel, which is what everyone likes to talk about these days. One thing that's concerning to me on Twitter is people just go, well, we know Israel did it. Or they go, well, we know the CIA did it. And, one of those I think is more likely than the other, but I think what we're going to find is that, especially when we look at Israel, yeah, like there's some motive stuff, but the lines don't connect. In my view, I know I'm going to get blown up by people, but we're going to cover it. And I haven't covered that in depth, so I can't rule it out, but that would not be consistent with the other stuff that I've studied in terms of another foreign power being involved.
Question for Fred. Why did most of the Warren Commission end up denying their own lone nut conclusions?
They didn't. That's just not true. I mean, if you look at what happened after with the Warren Commission, it's certainly true that Russell was not happy with the single bullet theory. And he certainly was unhappy. He thought perhaps there was a communist conspiracy. But I think the problem with the Warren, and this is a problem with the Warren Commission, I think the Warren Commission made some mistakes. One of the mistakes the Warren Commission made was, number one, they did not have the autopsy x-rays and photographs analyzed. They did not have a proper analysis of the wounds. But secondly, they did not explain the single bullet theory properly. Had the Warren Commission done proper trajectory diagrams and explained the single bullet theory in much more detail, then people like Richard Russell would not have had a problem. Of course, in the end, Richard Russell, all of them signed the Warren report and agree with it. And I could show you other documents from Hale Boggs, John Sherman Cooper, who again had trouble with the single bullet theory, but absolutely believed that Oswald was the lone gunman.
Matt, you're being asked if you've got theories of other shooters, including the driver.
All right. Well, just real quick on the Warren Commission. So Richard Russell, he gave his famous statement to, it was a phone call, recorded phone call, where he and LBJ together say, "I don't believe the single bullet theory." Okay. So that's
true.
That's true. Senator John Cooper said that it seems to me that Governor Connally's statement negates a conclusion that there was a single, that the single bullet theory was accurate. He said that in a BBC documentary. Congressman Hale Boggs, now his statement wasn't direct. Okay. So this is one of his friends that said that he said something. Okay. But maybe that friend just wanted to be famous. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of
Hale Boggs. And then Gerald Ford told the president of France, this is according to the president of France, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, that probably butchering that. So sorry for it. That he said, "Let me ask you an indiscreet question. You're on the Warren Commission. What conclusion did you arrive at?" And Ford told him, "Not a satisfactory one. We arrived at an initial conclusion. It was not the work of one person. It was something set up. We were sure it was set up, but we were not able to discover by whom. But we know we can't trust that because he's just the president of France and he wants to be famous one day."
Even Jefferson Morley, even Jefferson Morley says on that one, that's probably a really bad translation, that's the English and French got garbled in that that discussion.
Paul Blow speaks French and he wrote the section, but anyway,
But the conversation was between a French speaker and an English speaker, and a guy, there was probably some garbled stuff in there.
Okay. Sure. But that this little exchange here, this is a microcosm of the whole case. Big point, and then counterpoint that doesn't totally refute the big point. And then you go, there's a lot of there's a lot of uncertainty. I will say this, but then some things are more certain than others. What was your question?
So you've been asked by the viewers if you've got theories of other shooters, including the driver.
Okay, let's talk about the driver. Like, look, that theory has really proliferated over the years. All right. And there's two different theories, actually. There is a theory that the driver shot JFK, and there's also a theory that George Hickey in the follow-up car accidentally misfired his AR and shot JFK. So in addition to, and now look, what I'll give him is we can't count on the autopsy because that's forged. what you'd have to believe for that to be true. And by the way, this argument that it was a Secret Service driver, whether it's the driver or whether it's Greer, they argue that that's just an add-on to the official story. So Oswald acted alone, all that, and then it's just an accident. And then they went to these great lengths to cover up the accident by the Secret Service agent. That's not plausible to me. Once you know all the evidence, once you understand everything that's going on in the case, from a big picture standpoint, you would have to believe that the government would take extreme measures to cover up an accident. If there was an accident, they would throw that person under the bus. Maybe they wouldn't put him in jail. Maybe they feel bad for him. But that person's name would be Mud, just like the guy whose name was literally Mud. Right? Right? The doctor that hurt, that whatever, couldn't save Lincoln.
All right, Fred. So question for you. Who was the other guy arrested at the theater?
Yeah, there was no other guy arrested at the theater. It was just Oswald. That was it. Oswald was arrested at the theater. And that was it. There's just no truth to somebody else being arrested.
Anything to answer that? Okay. Question for Matt from Kat. What are your thoughts on Jolly West and his connection with JFK?
That's a great question. So for the people who don't know who Jolly West is, he's a fun one. So this is basically one of the main MK Ultra doctors who worked with the mind control experiments, okay, that the CIA was doing in the late 50s and in the 60s. And he came to prominence really through a book called Chaos by Tom O'Neill. That talks about Jolly West working with Charles Manson. I always want to say Marilyn Manson. Working with Charles Manson, basically giving LSD to Manson so that they could kind of, he could experiment, like, can this guy be a cult leader or what? Like, I need to reread that book. Hey, it's right here on my shoulder, Chaos. But anyway, so here's what else is fun about Jolly West. I'm gonna flash forward into the future for you, and then I'm going to come back. Jolly West happened to be when Timothy McVeigh was arrested, Jolly West was there, was the first doctor who visited him at the federal facility in Oklahoma. I found that to be so bizarre. Okay, whatever. Coincidence, all right? But going back into time now, so how's Jolly West involved with Jack Ruby? Well, Jolly West's name appears on the visiting doctor's log to go see Jack Ruby three different times. And I got a copy of that, an original copy of that from Buddy Walther's grandson. He had the original documents that, because Buddy Walther had befriended Jack Ruby, was in jail. So one of the times when Jolly West came to visit Jack Ruby was a couple of weeks before he testified before the Warren Commission. And when Ruby testified before the Warren Commission, he was just saying total nonsense. He was saying crazy stuff that made no sense at all. And so my theory would be that Jolly West was sent in there to scramble his brain so he talked craziness. Some people were like, oh, he got injected with cancer. I don't know. I mean, cancer was discovered and Ruby died 2 weeks later. I don't know. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that's definitively not true. I'm just saying there's no evidence for that. But there is evidence that Jolly West came to visit Jack Ruby three times. And then Jack Ruby spoke nonsense during his Warren Commission testimony. So my question would be, if it's not a nefarious reason, why on earth is the doctor who's running the MKUltra program visiting with Jack Ruby when he's in jail?
We've had O'Neill on the channel, and this is very suspicious, this MKUltra doctor.
Yeah, it's really true. Dr. Jolyon West was involved with MKUltra. So that's very, very true. His involvement ended in 1958. The reason he examined Jack Ruby was he was asked by Jack Ruby's lawyers. It was the defense team who asked Jolyon West to examine Ruby. They were the ones that wanted it. You could see that in the documents. The second thing, Ruby, to really understand Jack Ruby, you have to understand anti-Semitism. Ruby was greatly, greatly bothered by anti-Semitism throughout his life. He was Jewish. And if you go back to the morning of the assassination, there was a full-page ad in the Dallas Morning News criticizing Kennedy's foreign policy, and it was signed by Bernard Weissman. Ruby saw that ad. Weissman was a Jewish name. It greatly bothered him. And after the assassination, he wondered whether that ad, whether Bernard Weissman was involved in the assassination. And he wondered, would Jews be blamed for the assassination? He actually went to the post office box of Bernard Weissman to see if he could find out who this person was and where he lived. Of course, they wouldn't tell him for privacy reasons. Ruby started to go off the edge after the assassination because of the anti-Semitism angle. And when he testified before the Warren Commission, Jack Ruby wanted to go to Washington. He pleaded with the Warren Commission to take him to Washington. Now, why did he want to go to Washington? He told the Warren Commission exactly why he wanted to go to Washington. He wanted to warn Lyndon Johnson about a second Holocaust, that because he had shot Oswald, the John Birch Society and other far right wingers were claiming that Ruby was part of the conspiracy and therefore Jews would be blamed. And Ruby started thinking there would be a second Holocaust, and that's why he wanted to go to Washington. He went completely off his rocker because of anti-Semitism.
Or because of the LSD Jolly West was giving him, but either way, he did go off his rocker. I mean, Fred, you're saying that Jack Ruby's attorneys asked Jolly West to come down. To what end? Right. Jolly West wasn't known for anything other than being an MKUltra doctor. No, how could he help Jack Ruby?
He wasn't known for being MKUltra at the time. He was a very famous psychiatrist at the time. He was well known. In fact, the judge put together a whole list of people that could be asked to. He wanted actually a panel of people to look at Jack Ruby, and the judge also put Jolyon West on. I mean, Jolyon West had a massive reputation at that time. Nobody knew about MKUltra then.
I agree. No one knew about it. But to me, again, it's a coincidence threshold
and,
scenario.
And MKUltra was a massive failure. Nothing worked in MKUltra. They were complete failures at controlling people. It was a massive failure.
Fred, what do you think about the video of Jack Ruby saying that the people who were behind the assassination will never come to light? What
do you think I have a blog post around. Matt, you should see my blog post. I have the complete transcript, not just that snippet, the complete transcript of what Jack Ruby said. He was talking about he wanted his testimony. He wanted the lie detector test to come out. He wanted to prove to people that he was not involved in a conspiracy.
So when the reporter in the hall says, what do you mean, Jack? You mean like people high up? And then Jack says, if Adlai Stevenson was president, this wouldn't have happened. How do you connect that with what you just said?
Well, go to my blog. I have the complete transcript. Jack Ruby was clearly talking about his testimony. He was adamant that he wanted to prove he was not part of a conspiracy. And he was horrified what people were saying.
Again, the evidence is out there for everybody to go take a look at.
You can I have the complete transcript.
Yeah, look at all of it. It's all good. And I mean, there's been some disagreement between Fred and I about the primary evidence, but a lot of the primary evidence we agree on. And I can tell you that if once we even do get agreement, it probably won't change our overall, positions.
Well, talking about evidence, we've got another bullet point here. National Archives source the 7.65. As no entry number box 173 stack 65. So another rifle thought.
Right. That's what it would be, but again, this 7.65 bullet, just to be clear, we're talking about an envelope that had that written on it. We don't have the physical. If we had the physical bullet, that would be a much stronger argument. I think it's something, but you just throw it in the stew and you go, what's your coincidence threshold? And then you just keep throwing things in the stew and you have to explain every little tiny piece of vegetables in the stew. And, that's one way to do it. But hey, I got to run and pick up. I got to run to a parent teacher conference.
Oh, okay. We will let you go.
Five more minutes.
We've got, 10 minutes till it ends, but we'll continue with Fred till it ends with the rest of the questions because there's tons of them.
Well, Matt, thank you very much. I love talking with you because it's pretty civil, and I really like talking with you. I hope we have that beer.
All good, man. Yeah, no, it's just look, we should be able to disagree with each other respectfully. So I'm all for that. I'm all for there being dialogue as well. So it's good.
Matt, did Oswald meet up with his handler in the theater? Amy wants to know.
So Oswald met with. So first of all, there's not a list of all the witnesses who are in the Texas theater. Isn't that something? How is there not a list? I don't know. I guess we just didn't get it. Okay. But some of the witnesses there, name I forget, but there's one witness there who says Oswald was speaking to this woman who was pregnant and got up. The woman got up and left, and she was gone before the cops came. She wasn't there. So if he was, that was her, but we have no proof of that. He was, and this is something I haven't dove deep into, but supposedly he had I'll say what I know instead of speculating. He was going around to close sitting next to each person who was there in the theater. It's a matinee. There's only a few people there. It's a middle of the day on a Friday. It wasn't crowded at all. And it's like, why would Oswald go get his gun and then kill and then walk back to a cop, kill a cop after he was already walking away from him, turn around, walk back to the cop and then go to a movie theater. Well, if he was told to go to a movie theater, it would make a lot more sense why he would be there. But that is speculation. I don't know, but that is what I suspect.
I would say, look, he wasn't going to meet a handler. I mean, if he really was going to meet a handler, he would have paid admission. Why call attention to yourself and sneak in and not pay admission? He would have paid admission, gone in and met his handler. Instead, he sneaks in and calls attention to himself, ends up getting arrested.
The second person who came in didn't pay. The first person, as far as, he would have arrived at 107. So whether or not someone who looked like Oswald, who was the real Oswald, that arrived at 107 and paid, that's not, she wasn't asked about that. She was just asked about who was this guy who came in, who came running from the Tippit crime scene, who I think went out the back of the building. And then that's who's seen in that vehicle.
It was Oswald. I mean, I'll say one thing that really, and I would ask you, Matt, I would ask this of any conspiracy theorist. take all of the stuff that you say, the planted evidence, the multiple guns, the planted fragments, the fake autopsy, the fake this, put it into a one big, large narrative. Tell me how it all fits together into one large. It doesn't work. Well, you have a massive conspiracy that is so large and so big, it would be absolutely ridiculous.
I mean, to answer that question, that's getting into a season three topic of who exactly did it and why. But, you know, things are extremely compartmentalized. And then just also remember that when you have the story of, hey, don't snoop around too much, you're going to lead to nuclear war, that's kind of enough. You know, everybody's just going around thinking, oh, man, I got him to testify to the single gunman side of things. We are saving lives today. Let's go eat a steak, you know.
Will we ever get the full unredacted truth? If not, why release anything?
I don't think so, because I don't think that they, I think anything that would be salacious has already been destroyed. I'll say this, the things that are, that have demonstrated, in my view, that Oswald was affiliated with the CIA, like the routing of his files internally, the fact that they didn't go to the Soviet Russia division, which is where they would go if he was being watched. Instead, they went to the Office of Security, which is where they would go if he was being dangled as bait and working for the CIA. Never heard a counterpoint to that, by the way. The point is, you have to be hip to the metadata of what all these things mean to know if you're releasing something that's really damaging to you. So we're assuming that all the folks I still think the government's stupid, okay? So I think that we could get some mistaken releases, okay, of good stuff. But I don't think we only have the things that were already turned over to the ARRB to be released. Things that were never turned over, that's not even in the collection. FBI just discovered 2,400 documents that they never turned over, apparently. By the way, the Secret Service was subpoenaed by the ARRB in the 90s to turn over the information they had about JFK's fall motorcades, and they destroyed the documents after they had already been told to hold them. So I expect nothing from the government.
By the way, I posted on my website.
They're going to act viciously, actually.
I posted on my website the Chicago survey report. I also have the Tampa survey report. People said they were destroyed. I found them in the HSCA documents. The problem is that some of these documents were given to the HSCA. What the Secret Service destroyed was some of the threat records for privacy concerns.
It's just weird that they destroyed them while there was an active subpoena
for the truth.
Documents that there's already were around from 63.
All the documents that will come out in the new process, there's nothing in them because we know exactly how all we have are redacted documents. There's around 3,000 documents just with some redactions. Not much is redacted. None of those documents have anything to do with the assassination. They are all non-assassination related documents, typically about Cuba, the Cold War. There's nothing in them. And you can see all those documents right now on the Transparency Plan in the Mary Farrell Forum. And you can see exactly what is redacted. There's not that much.
There's also the deed of gift from the Kennedy family. That's an interview with Jackie Kennedy and with Robert Kennedy, with William Manchester. Yeah,
these are documents that are outside of the JFK collection. I hope they get them. That will require an act of Congress. You can't just Trump can't just declassify that. What do you think Jackie told LBJ? She liked LBJ. I mean,
Jackie liked LBJ at all. Yeah, I think that's all. I think Jackie knew that LBJ was whether or not LBJ had anything to do with killing Kennedy. LBJ was a violent psychopath who should not be remembered as a good person. And we're going to uncover that.
Matt, do you want to just tell the viewers where they can find you and support you?
SolvingJFKpodcast.com. Twitter's where I'm most active, SolvingJFK. I'm on Instagram and TikTok too. We're on YouTube as well. Season 3 starts on March 5th.
Appreciate it. We'll let you go. We've got 2 minutes to give Fred a few more questions. But
all right, thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Later, Fred.
Cheers,
see you, man.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah, bye.
Fred, you're getting asked, why were so many people bumped off around this case?
Nobody's been bumped off. You can't find one case of a mysterious death that really stands scrutiny. This is a complete red herring. Not one person has been bumped off. And I should add, people like Mark Lane, who talked about the conspiracy for years, lived until his 90s. This is just a ridiculous factoid of conspiracy theorists.
Right, okay. What evidence have you seen that convinced you Oswald was at the Texas depository that day?
Well, he went to work with Buell Wesley Frazier that morning. We have his his clipboard of the orders that he was supposed to finish. He was seen around 12 o'clock on the sixth floor. He brought his rifle. We have lots of evidence he was there. And of course, what's really interesting, he has no alibi. Nobody saw him during the assassination outside or in the lunchroom. Not one witness saw Oswald anywhere.
Yeah, and we've got his workmate, Buell, coming on, I think on Saturday, actually.
I had dinner with him last time I was in Dallas.
It's going to be interesting. Was there brain matter on Jackie?
I don't know. I don't know. There might have been. Look, brain matter sprayed up in the air. A lot of people were sprayed with it was a combination of blood, bone, skin, and other brain fluids that flung up in the air. You could actually see the direction that all that stuff went, and it went forward, meaning the shot came from behind. It's really, really quite clear. I don't know if Jackie was hit or not.
Do you think Oswald had anything to do with the CIA?
No, he was not the type of person the CIA would hire. I mean, Oswald had trouble reading and writing. He was dyslexic. He was hardly the type of person the CIA would hire. That's not the kind of people they need.
Right, we have run out of time before the next show. This has been great, Fred. And can you just tell the viewers where they can find you and support you, please?
Well, I've got four books on Amazon that debunk conspiracy theories. And you could find my blog on thetrailofdelusion.com. That's on thetrailofdelusion.com. I've got over 1,000 articles. It's all for free. A lot of primary documents on the case. That's my specialty, is primary documents. It's all there for free on thetrailofdelusion.com.
All right. You have a great rest of your day. And thank you for joining us and spending time. It's
thank
been
very much. It was great.
It's informative. Thank you. Cheers, Fred. All right, guys. So that was a blast. Thank you for all of your questions. And in the chat, I don't know if anyone's minds have been changed, which side you're on. In the chat, put a one if you side with Fred's theory of lone gunman. And put a two in the chat if you think there was a conspiracy. And put a three in the chat if you're staying tuned for Chris Todd. Chris Todd is back. He's coming in shortly. Actually, we're going over. It looks like it's mostly twos. Great poker face. Thank you indeed. So we're going to end this one. We're going to go over to Todd. Let me see if he's in the studio right now. I will check for you folks. This one will take you over to him. Let me just make sure that is all set up to do so. No, it's not. Right, where is it? Chris Todd, did he get in suing NBC for 100 million? And let me enter the studio now and see if he's there. And we will get on with it. And yes, yes, Chris Todd is in the studio, folks. So get your questions ready for all things Diddy and lawsuits. And I'm going to end this one. It will take you right over if it doesn't click on the channel icon. And it's...
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over a million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.